You're listening to the FQXI podcast. I'm Zia Morali, and today we're searching for the essence of free will. Regular listeners of the Foundational Questions Institute podcast will be very familiar with the dulcet tones of quantum physicist Ian Durham of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. He joins us each December to run through the best physics advances of the year. But in addition to his role as a physics pundit for FQXI, Durham is a researcher in his own right. And now you'll get to hear about his current work investigating whether our choices are determined by physics or whether we can control them. We're currently highlighting the best talks from the recent FQXI meeting in Tuscany in July, where Durham presented his steps towards a formal model of free will. That's a hugely ambitious project. Some philosophers and scientists in the past have attempted to invoke quantum indeterminism, the fact that the goings-on in the subatomic world are unpredictable, to break the chain of determinism that would otherwise shackle our choices. But while that might give us freedom, it's harder to come up with a mechanism for how our choices are governed by our own wills. So here's Ian Durham's full talk from the meeting, in which you'll hear how pondering whether to snack on carrots or peppers led him to muse about the probability of macro states occurring and come up with a mathematical measure of free will.
I want to thank Max and Anthony and Kavita, wherever she is, for all the awesome work. It's another great conference. And I also want to point out that this work actually grew out of several FQXI-related things. You'll notice anyone who was at the Copenhagen Bergen conference 8 years ago, that picture was taken. It's on a side street in Bergen somewhere on your way down the hill. Somebody just put up a random sign this way, that way. So that was from that conference. That's when I started thinking about this stuff. And then an essay contest, one of the essay contests, sort of inspired this. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about free will. But before I do that, I want to make a quick announcement. I'm part of a group of people who are organizing a Models of Consciousness conference in Oxford in September. I do want to point out, so these are some of the speakers that are listed. We've got about 70 people coming, and it should be really good. Okay, so I'm going to kind of skip this slide for the most part, other than to point out this quote by Robert Nozick that an action's being non-determined is not sufficient for it to be free. It might just be a random act, and that's something that is relatively important to this talk. So what is the essence of free will? So the essence of free will is, if I open my refrigerator, and, well, first of all, this is assuming there's anything in my refrigerator. My son is sitting here, and he usually eats most of it. But if I want a carrot, okay, or perhaps a pepper, so let's say I have carrots and peppers in my refrigerator. If I make the choice that I want a carrot at that particular moment, I reach in and I grab a carrot, and then I start eating it. Part of the assumption is that between the moment that I make the decision to eat the carrot and the moment and the point at which it gets eaten by me, it doesn't spontaneously turn into a pepper or a potato or something. We have this sense when we make choices that whatever we choose has a high degree of probability of occurring, right? Otherwise, there's no point in making the choice, right? If I could say, well, I want a carrot, but I know that if I stick my hand in there, I could get a rabbit, right? If that happened every time I went into my refrigerator, I would just give up. I wouldn't bother, you know, I'm not going to make a choice, right? I'm just going to reach my hand in, and whatever I get, right? So there's this sense that there's some level of confidence that comes with making choices, that the choice we make is going to come true. So let's think of the world in terms of processes instead. And I'll come back to choices in a minute. So if we think of the world as being made up of processes, you kind of have a continuum of processes. You can have deterministic processes, where like a fully deterministic process is one that just has one single outcome. Or maybe it has many outcomes, but only one outcome not even dominates, but is absolutely, if it's fully deterministic, it's the only outcome that occurs. So there's really just one outcome. That's a deterministic process. Conversely, a completely random process is one where you have multiple outcomes and they're all equally likely, meaning the probability distribution is flat, right? That's a completely, fully random process. Now, all realistic processes that we encounter in everyday life are somewhere between the two, right? We rarely encounter fully random processes, unless we're dealing with quantum random number generators or something. Of course, we very rarely deal with fully deterministic processes either. I gave the refrigerator example to Matt Liefer, who's here at one point, and he made some comment about, well, you know, it's never happened yet, right? And implying that maybe if I lived the age of the universe, that at some point I would reach in expecting a carrot and it would be a pepper, but who knows? So going back to the essence of free will then, there are some things that we can say about free will. First of all, free will is based on our ability to make certain choices freely. So the first thing we're going to say about free will is that we're going to break free will down into the concept of us making choices. And the choices, we have to be able to label choices themselves as individually being free, okay? And free will is going to be some kind of amalgam towards this. So a choice can really only be said to be free if an agent can make some kind of judgment about all the possible choices before they make the choice in order to weigh them against one another. So meaning they've got to have some meaning to us, right? Otherwise the choice is just random. The carrots and the peppers. When I open my refrigerator, I have to stop and think, do I want carrots or peppers? And the free choice is I have to be able to say, okay, I feel like I'm in the mood for carrots. So I'm gonna choose a carrot. I have the freedom to choose a carrot. Because if you think about it this way, if you were in jail, right, and you said, I want a steak dinner, right? And you went to the warden and said, I want a steak dinner, and the warden's gonna look at you and say, what are you, nuts? You're serving a life sentence. We don't serve steak dinners to people like you. So you can't freely make that choice, right? So there has to be meaning behind it. It has to have some, you have to be able to weigh these choices and make some decision. You have to have a reason that you make a choice over another choice. And the agent has to have a high degree of confidence that the choice will be realized. This is what I was just talking about with the refrigerator. You've got to, we have to have confidence that that is going to come true. That if we make a choice, it will actually occur. My take on it, and again, one of the goals of this research, by the way, was I've always wanted to come up with a theory that could be falsified by Scott Aronson. So maybe Scott will try to falsify this. So my take on this is that a certain an agent for whom a certain percentage of their choices is free could be said to have free will. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. Now, of course, the reality is that the world, from a physics standpoint, and I'm a quantum physicist normally, there's a continuum of models, right? We have quantum mechanics, which is highly probabilistic and in many cases completely random. And then we have, all the way up to like general relativity, which is, in theory, completely deterministic. So there are lots of different models out there. And one of the things that got me thinking about this was a recent essay contest where we were asked about how you could get something, our sort of deterministic world out of something more random, right? Underlying randomness. And it turns out this is actually a pretty standard thing that happens in statistical mechanics, for instance. So if you have interacting systems of random processes, they can actually converge to a deterministic macrostate if the multiplicity is high enough. This happens all the time, in fact. This is called the thermodynamic limit. So, for example, a classic example that doesn't quite get a spike like this in the multiplicity function is rolling a pair of die, right? So a single die remains a completely random, rolling a single fair die remains a completely random process, but when you put a pair of them together, you get some states that are more likely than others. And those are that has to do with the combinatorics of the math. There's nothing funky going on there. And it turns out you can actually get really big spikes in these things, for instance, in things like two-state paramagnets and stuff like that, where if you have interacting two-state paramagnets, you can make it so that one macrostate is overwhelmingly more probable than another. And I think, and that's for what I'm about to talk about, that's what's important. We want our choices, right? We want our choices to be, to have a macrostate that is going to be overwhelmingly probable compared to other ones. So if I choose, for it to be free, if I want to choose carrots, I want to be sure that I'm going to get carrots. So I want a multiplicity function that has a nice sharp peak, and it's not sort of curved. In order to build a formal model of free will, how would we do that? So I'm going to make a couple assumptions. One of the things I want to point out here is that I'm not claiming that anything that I'm saying here is absolutely the be-all, end-all. I'm basically doing what Scott said IIT was doing. Nobody's done this, so I'm just going to stick my neck out there and do it, and I could be completely wrong, but that's why FQXI exists, right? I can take chances like this here. And yes, you can laugh, that's all right, if it's totally crazy. But so one of the first things I'm going to do is assume that in my model of systems, the most fundamental systems are irreducible to other systems. So they contain no interactions and cannot be partitioned. So we'll just start with that, and we're going to build up from random systems and move in the direction of more deterministic things. So the microstates of a fundamental system then are all completely equally likely in the long run. So this is how I build the choices. We build the choices up from small systems and build towards highly probable macrostates through making the multiplicity peaks very sharp. So a possible choice, what I refer to as a choice, is a process, and in this case, it's a macro process that takes a system from one macrostate to another. And here is a key. The key difference is that different choices are different processes. So me reaching in to grab the carrots is a completely different process than me reaching in to grab a pepper. Those are completely different processes. It's not that we have two different outcomes of the same process. We have two completely different processes. So a system's macrostates are formed from interacting microprocesses. So that makes a that follows from the before. So the probability that a choice will lead to its macrostate is arbitrarily high if the choice is free. This is the same assumption I was talking about before. We want to assume that these things are nearly deterministic because otherwise we wouldn't make them. The number of n possible choices that a system has, in order for a specific set of choices or choice to be free, the choices that a person had before they made that, or a system had before they made that, has to be small enough to be read into the system's memory in finite time, right? It's not a free choice if you're going to sit there until the end of the universe counting up all your options, right? That's not a free choice. You have to be able to process it. So there has to be some limitations that come through from that. And the choices that are available to the system have to be determined by a combination of environmental forcing and internal dynamics. So our context, the context we're in, determines somewhat the choices that we're given. A free choice doesn't mean you can literally do absolutely anything. A free choice is somewhat determined by the context that you're in, right? So I can't just run outside and expect there's to be snow on the ground. I'm in Tuscany in the summer. It's not going to happen. So, and the choices, here's the other key. The other choices don't change prior to the decision by the agent, right? So if I make a choice, after I've read through all the choices, in the process of reading through all the choices, some of the choices don't suddenly change. I want that to be true most of the time. So how do I capture this mathematically? So let's consider a set of choices, and they all have distribution functions, and mu is the mean, and sigma is the variance of each of these. I can actually represent them as what's called a mixed distribution. My father is a retired English teacher and would cringe at the word mixed distribution. I don't like that. That doesn't seem like proper grammar, but that's what it's called. It's called a mixed distribution. And each of these things has weights. And so the weights are where the meaning come in. This is how we assign meaning to each individual choice. And f of x is a convex function. So it's basically a multimodal distribution, right? And the distance between any two modes is given by this thing called the Mahalanobis distance. And here, sigma is actually the covariance matrix between any two, for any two choices. And the clear sense here is that, for instance, the Mahalanobis distance between, say, a pepper and a carrot is larger than, say, the Mahalanobis distance between one carrot and another carrot, right? So you might have a short carrot and a long carrot. Well, that's going to have a smaller Mahalanobis distance than a distance between a carrot and, thank you, 5 minutes, than one carrot and a pepper, for example. All right, so I'm using the Mahalanobis distance as a measure of how distinct the choices are. And the assumption is that the larger that value, the more distinct those choices are. For a given choice, or a set of choices, and then you make the choice, for a given number of possible choices, n, the freedom of choice, I, is given by some function that is it's a function of the minimum Mahalanobis distance between this choice and any other choice in the ensemble, and what I'm calling, so I call it tau of n, which is the time it takes to read all n choices into memory and process them, okay? And it should be inversely proportional to that. And also inversely proportional to the variance, because the variance is what tells you the sharpness of the peak, right? So, or it's one measure for the sharpness of the peak that you can do. There are others, but right now I'm working with that one. So this is what defines a free choice, the zeta function. And that's for a single free choice. So there are lots of choices that could be free, and they could be made by systems that don't have free will. But that the point is what is free will then? So a measure of free will would be if you had a given number of processes that result in choices, a system's free will is going to be given by some kind of partition function that is a function of all of the zetas for the different choices. Meaning the level of free will depends in some way on the freedom of the choices under consideration. And the expectation of this is that there are going to be different levels of free will for different systems. So, for instance, an increasing level of complexity is going to lead to an increasing level of free will from a bumblebee or a honeybee to maybe a computer to my wife. And it's not, you know, I assume that the level of free will goes up that way. Maybe it doesn't, but that would be my assumption. So this leaves a bunch of questions, of course. So first can this model produce real measurable results? And I'm hoping eventually that it does. Does it necessarily presuppose a dualist view of consciousness? It certainly is panpsychist. Whether it's dualist or not, I haven't decided. It certainly seems like it ought to be. But I'm not entirely sure about that. I had some interesting discussions with Paul Davies on the Height today about that, so I haven't figured that one out yet. Is it compatible with existing theory, formal models of consciousness? So that's one interesting thing I'm looking at. I would like it to be at least compatible with IIT. For the same reason that I like IIT, but and I think it's 2 minutes, thank you. I think that's it's a good thing to be at least reasonably, like it shouldn't contradict it, let's say that. As a quantum guy, I'm always motivated by quantum things, and so I'm curious to see if this model can make predictions that are consistent with various models like the Bell tests. Because the free will assumption is an assumption that is made when you do a Bell test. Can I work this into some kind of Bell model? And I, you know,
that's trickier than you would think. But anyway, these are some questions that, of course, it raises. It raises lots of other questions as well. But I just want to take a moment then to acknowledge a couple of people for sort of pushing me along on this project, Robert Prentner, and some folks at a workshop I helped run in Dorfstein a few months back. I thank my son for making a key point on meaning. And then if you're interested in some of the early ideas, these are a couple of papers here that I published on it. I should have a paper on the whole thing coming up soon. Grazie.
That was Ian Durham sharing a new model of free will at FQXI's 6th international meeting in Tuscany in July. Durham has also written up more detailed notes about the model for our blog, and I'm linking to those on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. So feel free to discuss his model with him directly there. And you can also contact us on Twitter at FQXI, on Facebook at FQXI Physics, or by email at podcast@fqxi.org. Fans of Durham's insightful commentary on physics in general will be pleased to hear that he will also be blogging about some of the other themes from the meeting that grabbed his attention. So make sure you visit the FQXI website to read his analysis of some of the other talks, as he'll be posting them soon. We'll also be adding more audio and eventually the video from the meeting too. That's all for now. I've been Zia Morali. Thank you for listening.